Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 411, which is incidentally my mother's height, because she's tiny and Italian and adorable. It's-a me, a Mario. Oh, I gotta say that to her next time I talk to her. My other mom, Matt Myra. No, Matt's not my mom. Matt Myra's like, he's like a cousin. Matt Myra's your cousin, and my cousin. So my cousin and I will be coming to perform in Boston this week at the Wilbur Theater, September 27th. Tickets on that are at nerdist.com/calendar. And, the final episode of Breaking Bad is coming up on the 29th. Oh, man. Seriously? Yes, seriously. So, final episode, it's going to be 75 minutes long, and then immediately afterwards, there's no Low Winter Sun in between. We're going to do Talking Bad immediately afterwards. It's going to be an hour long, and we're doing it from Hollywood Forever Cemetery, which is an historic cemetery in Los Angeles where they have a lot of events, but folks are actually buried there, like Johnny Ramone. It's a really cool place, and Aaron Paul's throwing a big bash for the series finale. So we're sort of integrating, and we're going to do our Talking Bad from there. So a lot of cast members are going to be on. I hear Gus Fring might be making an appearance. And Aaron's doing all this for charity. So if you go to omaze.com, O-M-A-Z-E, you can find out info on the charity and then also figure out, I think there's a contest where he's going to send some Breaking Bad fans to the finale. So we will be there next Sunday. I'd like to thank HostGator for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast, which is an amazing place to get a website. They offer premium web hosting at low costs. If you can't get a .com, are there even .coms available anymore? I think every character combination has been soaked up in the .com, so grab a .net. And you don't have to have a domain that's like 180 characters. HostGator offers 24/7, 365 phone, chat, and email support. They're going to offer you hosting with any size site you want with shared VPS and dedicated servers. And they can now move your site for you if you want to transfer to HostGator. So go to HostGator.com, buy some hosting, get some .NETs, and use the promo code NERDIST to get an extra 30% off and support the Nerdist Podcast. See, I almost said support your favorite show, but I don't know if this is your favorite show. Again, maybe it was the closest one to your hand. This episode is Metallica, and I didn't know what to expect, and they were fucking awesome! We recorded them at Comic-Con, and then we held on to it so that we could post it near the time that their movie, Metallica, Through the Never, comes out. It's coming out in IMAX on Friday, September 27th, and then in wide release in all theaters on October 4th. Maybe not all, but a lot. Through the Never is... it's sort of like it takes band footage, and then there's a fictionalized storyline featuring a guy as a roadie who's charged with a special mission while the band plays. So, it is documentary-fic? Biofic? Hey, biofic. I think I just made that up. But if I didn't, I'm sure you'll tell me, Internet. But Metallica was great. It was James and Kirk, and Lars was not there, which was very fortunate because I was really hoping to watch Jonah Ray squirm because he has a Lars Ulrich bit in his stand-up special, which aired a few months ago. But alas, no Lars to make Jonah uncomfortable. And again, fantastic chat with these guys. So much fun to hang out with. So here you go, the Nerdist Podcast number 411 with Metallica.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
We'll be right back.
Metallica podcast.
It's already started.
It's already started.
That was it.
Okay.
Cool.
Cool. You, can I go surf
We are that
now?
Good.
Yeah. No, I didn't say it was the end. I said it was the beginning.
Oh, shoot.
I don't think you're going to catch any waves out there.
Yeah, that's
not so much. This is not where the waves are. The waves are out there.
You'll just get hit by a maple.
Actually, if you look right out the window, there's a bunch of people. You could crowd surf.
Yeah. I can actually wait later on tonight.
Or just find the biggest nerd and then have him jump into the water on the other side of the bay and then catch whatever swells happen because of that.
Yes, the nerd wave.
Nerd waves. Listen, that's an album title. If you guys want to use it, it's totally yours.
Thank you.
We will give you nerd waves.
Thank you. I'm glad you released that one.
I was going to ask him if we can name the album Gluten 3.
I'm not going to lie. I kind of love the name.
Gluten 3. It's actually my new product. Gluten 3.
Is this really a
gluten free dish? No. It's gluten 3.
Yeah.
It's three times the gluten.
It's just gluten in pure form, which people could be sludge. I don't know what gluten looks like.
That's going to confuse a lot of people and make a lot of people very ill.
My wife is gluten-free. Gluten-free, so I'm always cracking these gluten jokes. Sorry.
No, that's okay. The advocate could be a love letter to her.
Yeah.
Be like, look, boy, I'm going to eat all the gluten
I need
for
that.
You.
We'd be glad to hear any more puns you got.
Very heroic of you. Take all the gluten.
Yeah.
That could harm her.
Yeah, exactly. But my new product, gluten-free, is like, you would like smear it on sandwiches or put it on potatoes.
I love it. It's like
pour it on rice. Yeah. Yeah.
Stuff that needs gluten.
Exactly.
Vegetables. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Too healthy.
Fruit.
Yeah. This broccoli's nice, but I want to feel bloated.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, now
I need to be itchy.
This is
my marketing wheel.
Kirk Hammett's gluten free.
It's good for surfing, too. You're more buoyant.
Yeah, exactly. Back, you could smear it on the top of your board, and it'll keep you on the board.
NFL receivers start putting on other gloves.
Yeah.
Are there album titles where you're like, if we just didn't give a shit anymore, just to be silly, we should just name it this? Do you guys have fake joke album titles?
Every album you start goofing off, and then actually there's some reality to them eventually.
Yeah.
Even with song titles, you're coming up with song titles that wherever it originated from. Usually it starts off as the city where the riff came to mind. Okay, Casper is the name of this one.
Yeah.
It was Casper, Wyoming, or... Yeah. We had something called Black Squirrel. Why was it Black Squirrel?
Because
it was in D.C. where there's black squirrels out in the this park. So you just kind of run with it, and then the song's called Black Squirrel, and Black Squirrel.
And then people attach all this meaning.
Yeah.
No, man, just it's about the tiny evil. Darkness that lives in all of our trees.
I saw a few of them in line, Black Squirrel.
Yeah. There's this one song that I knew for a couple years called Skimpy. And whenever I refer to it, I call it Skimpy. I still don't know the real working title.
That's true. Every time you and Lars say, hey, we should play Skimpy, it's like, can you guys tell me what song that really is? Because I'm not in on the Skimpy, Ren and Skimpy,
here, we'll play
whatever.
It for you.
Exactly.
I mean, do you ever feel sort of constrained at all by the style of music where you're like, guys, come on, let's just throw some tubas. Like, do you ever think, like, oh, just
tubas.
One day?
Hey, bro, tubas can be heavy if it's in the right.
All right,
it's
right,
the heaviest wind instrument.
It just gets it. Really is. Yeah, it just gets serious for a second.
Getting back to the song titles and album titles, we have a big sheet hanging in our studio where you can just go up there and just like write down, stream of consciousness titles, lyrics, ideas, whatever, and. Over the course of time, it gets pretty hilarious. Pretty hilarious. In fact, I think at one point for Death Magnetic, we were actually thinking about taking pictures of all our notes and plastering them somewhere in the album. Just for entertainment's sake.
Fart Monster, what was that?
Yeah. Made in China, that's the new one.
Yeah.
Made in China.
The best dressed chicken in town.
Oh, please do it. Please do it.
With tubas.
Yeah. See, because if you did that, people would still find some dark meaning behind it. They'd be like, hey guys, I'm being funny. They're like, yeah man, the best dressed chicken. That fucking
exactly.
Heaviest thing ever.
This chicken is so metal.
This chicken's so heavy and the best dressed.
Do you ever feel, though, sort of constrained? I mean, at this point, after all these years, do you sort of feel like, well, we really kind of got to stick in this lane?
I think we feed off of that, and we always have. You know, what's the normal? What are the rules of heavy metal? And let's go break them, shall we?
Yeah, you know? Let's go somewhere different.
Yeah. We've always been adventurous, you know, and explorers. A prime example, cutting our hair. That was, well, I guess yours is long. Never mind.
It was no dirt. Yeah.
How do you unsell out? That's what happened. Yeah.
But so cutting our hair was one of those things that was like, oh, God, they've lost their minds. They're out of it, blah, blah, blah,
they
whatever.
They can't play.
We broke the rules of the heavy metal fashion world.
Yeah, that was always the thing that, like, you could tell the difference. It's like if they were a hardcore band or a metal band. Well, the hardcore band has short hair. Yeah, and the metal bands have long hair. That's how you know. Yeah.
Well, now, you know, none of us have real beards, you know, so we're still not metal.
Yeah.
We're supposed to have a beard now.
I'm actually have been trying to grow a beard for the last 20 years.
This is what's come up. Beard growing contest.
I cannot grow a beard.
What?
Right.
I just won.
You did.
You did. That was real fun.
Yeah.
You're
a hip. What are you doing here?
But it's something as silly as that, like cutting your hair. You know, what, you're not supposed to cut your hair now? I mean, yeah, just kind of ridiculous. Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, doing a ballad. All right, they've sold out. Then, oh, you did a video, you sold out. There's always, you know, whenever you expand your horizon or go outside of the box, it scares people, you know? The people that kind of depend on you to be their leader of sorts. And when you do something different, wait a minute, you know? And then I think they either become okay with it and it helps them grow, or they just go, screw them, I'm going to this other band, you know?
People don't like change, but you have to evolve. I mean, like, you personally sort of have to at some point. You can't just do the same exact. I mean, it's like, how do you find that balance between, well, we want to give them enough of, you know, something that they feel comfortable with, but then still be able to evolve at the same time?
Well, at the end of the day, it's all about honesty. And if you're making it for yourself, it's like, hey, when I grow up, I want to be a role model. You know, you don't do that. You just do it by living. You just experience. And if you're honest with yourself about it, people will hopefully realize that. Because you don't fake being a role model. You know, you don't fake being something that's authentic.
Yeah. I mean, we've always tried to come from a place of integrity in everything we've done, no matter how jarring it's been to our fans or how challenging. I mean, it's something that we've actually, you know, felt from our gut and from our hearts and from our minds. I mean, and if we feel that it's the right thing to do, then it is the right thing to do. And if anyone else doesn't like it, you know, they'll have to, like, find ways to deal with that. I mean, it's really not our problem.
Their stuff.
Well, we've talked to a lot of people who have sort of ascended. It's like sort of the top of their own food chain, you know, like culturally or, you know, in entertainment. And I'm always sort of fascinated by this idea that at a certain point you kind of don't own your stuff anymore. Like your fans sort of take ownership over it. And sort of like you said, how could you do that or how could you do this? So, you know, was there ever a point where you grappled with that, or were you always able to just sort of, you know, like, well, we're going to do this and you guys will just have to be okay with it?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because when we were making our last album, you know, when you make an album, you have a very intimate relationship with the music. You take it, you know, when it's at its very purest form, and you develop it, and you know, it's kind of like an embryonic thing. It just grows until it shapes into something, and then once it's finally a song, we rehearse it, we record it, we live with it, and we shape it. And then there comes a time when you think, wow, all right, this music is going to be released pretty soon. This music won't be our own personal stuff anymore. It'll be out there, and and the world will own it. Because in essence, you know, music is really, really free. You know, in essence, I mean, you can get into the whole intellectual property thing, but that's something else. But you know, it's interesting you say that, because I really feel that once you release a song, it really isn't yours anymore in that personal way. And it's just interesting to watch how, once you let it go, what happens to that. You
it's
know,
like it's raising like, a kid.
Exactly.
Like,
you know,
18, you're like,
yeah. It, and then after it gets out there, you really don't have any control over it anymore.
Right.
You can still perform the song, and you know, but you know, once
but
it's
so
out
can
there,
anyone else.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah, and then you know, if someone ever confronts you about it, and you could say, oh, this song is about this, and then the fans will go, no, it's not.
Yeah.
It's about this because they sort of attach
it is.
Yeah. Whatever, you know.
Exactly.
That's why telling people what the song's about is just no good. You know, it's my opinion. You know. Whatever that means to you is more important.
Right.
That's how a song gets connected to people, you know? If you're too blatant and obvious about stuff, it actually limits your audience. If you give some vagueness and have layers to it, people can apply it to their lives. And just like the lyric that you thought it was, and then you actually read the lyrics going, oh, my God. I was singing it the whole, you know, the wrong time.
Sometimes
the wrong
for
way
decades.
The whole time. But you know what? Actually, mine's better.
Do you have a song that you meant something particular to you when you were writing it, and then the fans have taken it, and it was just meant something completely different to the fans? Like, is there a song that was like, you know, this is actually about my dog, and someone was like, this is about my life.
When it was actually about my cat.
Yeah,
exactly. Or my friend's dog.
Yeah. Way different, man.
So you don't
you're way off track.
My friend's dog, Sandman, is all about him.
Yeah. Tell us.
Oh, it's about him.
It's about my dog
that just
coming
became
through
real
the little
gross.
Doggy hole. Yeah.
That's why the song is dark, dude. No one can ever know the real me.
One is actually about the action figure that I blew up and I lost.
Yeah,
off.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the GI Joe.
Oh. It's an ode to it,
but
old
with real
toy.
Hair.
Yeah, I'm sure Puppets is about
Jackson.
Yeah,
that was about my GI Joe with Kung Fu grip.
I think every song is that.
Yeah.
Every song is that, and I love that it is.
Yeah.
That's why I don't want to go into detail what it means to me. It limits. You know, imagination is free and amazing, and it helps you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember one time a friend of mine had a song, an album. I loved it, and I told him, I was like, I want to talk to you about the song. It's great. It's about this and this and this and this, right? Just like gave him a whole like
right.
5-minute speech about what it was. He's like, no, it's a song about Nancy Reagan and speed. It's not about like us growing up. And,
that was my second guess.
Yeah, yeah. That song. Wired Resident, I think.
Yeah. Was it about Nancy Reagan doing speed, or just Nancy? Like Nancy Reagan was one theme, and then there was a whole speed.
It
subtext.
Was well. That's the thing. He had this kind of vague interpretation of just like, you know, like Reagan politics and Nancy Reagan doing speed, and I thought it was just about when we were living in San Pedro and a bunch of us were doing drugs.
That's such an abstract.
Yeah,
song
he's a real weirdo.
We're all Nancy Reagan at heart.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
The meaning behind it all.
On speed.
There's a little
just
Nancy in us
say
all.
No.
Yeah. Isn't there a little Nancy speed in everyone?
I think there is. The best kind of speed is Nancy Reagan speed.
What? So, but like to Matt's question, was there a specific one where you're like, oh yeah, they got it all? Like technically, like really, they got it all wrong. What was one example?
I don't know. I for some reason I can't. You know, Seek and Destroy is actually about building things. No. You know, building things so you can destroy them.
No. Or destroying the empty space.
Yeah.
Destroying the empty space.
One of the funniest things, this is a little off track, but we were doing our earliest shows, and we finally got one of the guys, Xavier Russell from Kerrang! Magazine, which was like,
journalist.
Oh, Kerrang! Yeah. You know, of the day. He came out and he reviewed our show. And at the end of the set where we play Seek and Destroy, he wrote down, and one of their best songs, She Can Destroy.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that was good.
But maybe it helped get some girls at our show.
Yeah.
So
I don't think it did.
There's a silver lining.
There's this metal band really into women empowerment. You gotta check them out.
They never played that song that I read about. I didn't hear that anywhere.
She Can Destroy. Come on, female power. Or, yeah.
You
know,
you guys started the Riot Girl movement.
I think Pussy Riot are going to cover that.
Yeah. Oh my God, they should. I would pay for that.
Yeah.
What? is there any sort of, did you ever worry about success in terms of, you know, I mean, like, this music is all about, like, just fucking rebellion and breaking things down and tearing things down. And then, but then you become successful and you're, you know, do you worried? It's like, oh, well, I'll get comfortable. Maybe we won't feel that stuff anymore. Or maybe we won't.
Success is not a cure.
Right.
You know, it's definitely not a cure. If you have certain feelings and you use that as a source for inspiration, you know, you over time, success might change you externally, but internally, you know, if you still have those issues, you're going to always have those issues.
Right.
And, you know, for me, I mean, I can only speak for myself. I have certain conditions in my life that I think have helped me become the musician and the person I am, and I've learned how to accept that. And success has not cured any of those conditions at all. In fact, it's aided me, but it's also held me back in certain ways. And so, you know, my reply to the whole, you know, does success change you? It changes certain things, but you know, if your core personality is your core personality, and that I feel if you're using that as a source for inspiration, that core personality never really changes. And so, there you go.
And depending on what your version of success is, yeah. You know,
oh, yeah. Piles of money.
Yeah. Piles of women.
Okay. You know, piles of money. It also equals piles of taxes, bro.
Yeah. It's almost as if mo' money, mo' problems.
What?
Yeah. Almost.
Oh, you guys should make a song called that.
Did you read the statistic that Pablo Escobar used to spend like $5,000 a week on rubber bands to bound the money that he had?
Jeez.
Oh my God.
And they would they would lose like hundreds of thousands of dollars every month to water damage and rats.
All right, Rubber Band Man. It's all about a guy who.
Exactly.
Do you have that guy's number?
He's dead.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he's dead.
Oh, that guy.
Oh, yeah.
My little friend. Yeah. Okay. No, and depends. Success can certainly become a jail for you. It can become. It creates new problems. You know. So there's always, like Kirk said, your the things that you have inside you that drive you or keep you back just morph into a new adventure of problems or success or realities for you. So
there you have it.
Is it weirdly everything's about to, we're all gonna die.
Is it weirdly ice
the end?
Yeah. I watch you see the videos of you playing, I think maybe it was Moscow or something. It looked like there was like 100,000 people.
More.
So
123,270.
We undersold it.
Do you remember the biggest show?
I only counted.
70 billion.
Yeah. I lost count.
Yeah, and 90.
Yeah.
Okay, gazillion check it out.
Gluten, 3 million people.
It, depending on who you ask, we've got reports from 250,000 to half a million to a million people. All I know was that there were so many people that when I tried to find the end of the line of people, all I saw was haze on the horizon. Jeez. And there were still people underneath that haze.
Oh, turned into haze.
Yeah. They followed the horizon line.
Yeah. Those people evaporated.
So we played Purple Haze.
Exactly.
That was. I remember like seeing footage of those huge shows you guys did, and it was like the times where like you would have people like, you know, clap along. It's like, I love seeing the fact that people are clapping at a different pace because the music is taking longer to get to the people. It's like, that's no place to see a band that far away.
if you're the 124,000 guy, and how are you just in the back like,
Hey, when I was 14 years old and I went to my big first rock concert, I was happy to be that 124,000th kid.
What was your big first rock concert?
I'm not going to tell you.
It's always closer than where you were. I mean,
exactly.
Never been to a concert.
Exactly.
That's closer than I was.
Exactly.
I'll tell you, my
first
one.
It was Neil
line.
Diamond, wasn't it?
No, my very first concert was Dionne Warwick and Isaac Hayes at the Circle Star Theater in 1975, and Shaft was in order.
No way.
My mom took my sister and I. And I was just blown away by the strobe lights when Isaac Hayes came out, and I heard,
oh,
Dude, that is killer.
That's pretty rad.
My second concert. Yeah. My second concert, like 6 years later.
Shut your mouth.
Yeah. Exactly.
Please cover Shaft.
Thin Lizzy. Yeah.
Oh, Thin Lizzy. Please cover your Shaft.
Yeah.
All right, Shaft. Let's take it out. That's what we're all talking about here.
My first concert was you guys.
All right.
Yeah. My very first concert was you guys in Hawaii.
I'm sorry.
Del Arena. That was great. I think I was in fourth or fifth grade, and I was frightened. Yeah, bro. Okay.
My first concert was going to be you guys at Foxborough Stadium with Guns N' Roses. And then my dad wouldn't let me go after the riots happened.
Right next to my dad.
You took the tickets.
We were rocks or whatever.
When you're on stage and there's that many people, do you feel like you are connected to that many people, or do you just sort of feel weirdly isolated because there are so many people?
Obviously, we wear different hats, and when you're up there, there's a performer hat that, you know, amplifies, you know, so the person way back there can actually see you, you know? And there's this
first
thing
they cut the hair, now they're wearing hats? God.
Yeah.
Metaphor
yeah.
Hats, man.
Yeah, pretty soon, bald. Bald wig. Bald wigs.
Yeah. I'm going to wear a hard hat. Yeah.
But, you know, that's really why, you know, the giant video screams.
That's a Tales from the Crypt
video pod. Screens came into play. So the 125,000th person could actually see you, you know, sweating or spitting on somebody or screwing the lyrics up, you know?
When you screw the lyric, if you feel like you're going to screw the lyrics up, or do you ever forget something and then you just kind of go, rrr, rrr, rrr.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Or, friggin' sound man. You know, I throw him under the bus for a while.
Sorry, James. Like, he totally takes it.
The mic's not working. You got to be honest. It's like, sometimes I'll just sing, I forgot the words, you know, and they'll fill in for you.
Do you have a prompter?
I have a word wedge.
Okay.
It's very different.
It's very different.
How many songs?
It's a glorified cheat sheet is what it is. Got the first word of every line, because as soon as I know the first word, it's like, okay. You know, I just puke out the rest of it, you know.
That's awesome.
How many songs have you written, do you think? Do you even know the number at this point?
No, I don't know the number. Lars will certainly know the number.
It's over 100, though.
Yeah.
I'm certain that it's over 100.
Are there songs that you have now when, obviously, because you've been doing this for so long, that you look back and you're like, what the fuck were we thinking? And like, but you still play them anyway because, you know, like, well, people want to hear these.
Every song.
Yeah.
Every song. Yeah. Or when you go back and you listen to, hey, we haven't played stuff from this album, or you listen to, okay, we gotta relearn this song, or prime examples when we did the 30-year anniversary for Metallica at the Fillmore, four nights at the Fillmore in San Francisco, which is a landmark for us in our lives and obviously the Bay Area. We tried to play a different song every night. There was a different set. So we played pretty much every song we owned, and you go back and you listen to stuff, and you go, whoa,
that's what I did?
Oh, my God. You got to dissect that. I got to go on YouTube and learn it. Someone can teach me this song.
Some seven-year-old
kid. Someone's
got
to teach me. Totally.
You have no, like, that is the dream of every, like, you know, metal guitar guy who's like, man, I wish I could teach Metallica how to play there. And now to know that actually happens.
It is true. It is so true.
And when we're on tour, I have to have like songbooks from all the albums so that I can have a quick reference if I need to figure out how to play a guitar solo of a song we haven't played in like 10 years. Because, you know, you don't remember that stuff. You're busy playing other things and it just kind of like slips away. So I have to have the songbook and like, oh, that's what I did. Oh, okay. And then,
good.
And then once you like get into it, you start remembering it, and then you say,
do you like to deviate?
What the hell was I just talking about?
On your solos? Do you like
I improvise all the time. In fact, you know, that's the one thing that I have that James doesn't. If I forget a guitar solo, I can just improvise. I mean, if he forgets a lyric,
I can improvise.
Yeah, you can improvise.
I'll just start singing a solo.
James
just started scatting in the middle of altos. It was amazing.
You do the Prince thing if you fuck up a lick. You just play it again so that everyone thinks it was intentional.
Yeah, exactly.
Or just turn your back.
There are no mistakes.
Or just do the James Brown and punch one of your bandmates and go, it was all his fault.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Have you guys been to Comic-Con before? Is this your first?
I have.
You have?
Yeah.
How many times have you been?
This is my third time. In San Diego. I've been to New York as well.
Yeah.
Are you guys... I used to go to Comic-Cons when I was a kid. And, bro... being at this Comic-Con just like totally screws my head, because I used to go to Comic-Cons when I was a kid in the 70s, all male.
Yep.
Everyone had glasses.
Yep.
Everyone was either dressed up as a Trekkie or, you know, a stormtrooper, and, you know, tops maybe 400 people. You know, by the end of the night, you knew everyone at every table. Now it's become like this huge juggernaut of a thing. There's all these like, all these people, all these hipsters, and all these females, and even like cute girls too. And like, and you know, this? I used to come to these things thinking, all right, I'm with my tribe. We're all dorks. Like, I feel free. Now I come to this again. I'm like, oh my god, I feel like a dork again.
Yeah.
We're all the dorks. What happened?
What are you doing
here? What happened? Where are my people? We've been infiltrated.
Make
this
way
is communism.
For the dorks.
Yeah.
Ah, normal people.
Ah. And so, you know, Comic-Con is a bit confusing to me nowadays, but I understand, you know, the whole drive behind it. I won't get into it, but you know, so to answer your question, yes, I have been to a Comic-Con a lot.
Where are you guys playing to? Are you playing on the ship? Was there was
where'd the ship go?
Oh, shit. No.
See those two jet skis?
Going to pick up the gear.
You guys were actually
bringing over by jet ski.
Yeah.
Hey, watch my guitar. Don't get it wet.
Yeah. Oh, there it goes.
Just holding it up.
Remember the chords. Yeah. Some poor roadie who's just determined to not get that guitar wet, but he can't. It's just water spraying in his face.
Oh, yeah.
The jet ski goes down. He's just swimming above his head.
Yeah.
Can you just call Kramer and get another one?
I couldn't make it, you guys. He just throws the guitar up and then
did you say Kramer?
I'm Jackson.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, no. ESP.
What,
the best company in the world. No.
Yes, we are playing.
Okay.
We are playing. I think the location was secret until today.
Oh, we don't
maybe?
Know.
Until right now.
Well, this isn't live.
This is going to be September.
Oh, okay, we're playing Spreckles Theater tonight.
Spreckles, okay, yeah. Cool.
In Speckle'sville.
Yeah.
Just outside.
Bunker Spreckles. Bunker Spreckles was an incredible world-class surfer in the 70s. And I think he was part of that Spreckles family.
Oh,
so there is a Spreckles'ville in Maui. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You guys know a lot about Hawaii, it
I
turns
lived
out.
There. I used to live there.
Oh, you used to live there.
We'd rather be there.
Yeah.
No.
What?
No. I'm kidding.
No, come on.
I
not
actually
really.
Came from Hawaii on Monday. I'm going back to Sunday.
Wait, so you were living in Waimanalo?
I used to live in Waimanalo. I lived there for 8 years, and then I moved back to the Bay Area last summer.
Oh, wow.
But I'm spending this summer there right now.
The thing about Waimanalo, it's not the nicest place. It's beautiful.
The hood.
Yeah, it's real.
There's this term called chronics, and they're basically drug addicts, roving drug addicts that live on the beach or in the parking lots, and you know, they're everywhere in that town.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing no one ever realizes about Hawaii is the amount of just fucked up meth heads just roaming around.
Yeah, smoking ice.
Batu.
Batu. And it's interesting because, like, the police have come and empty out all the parking lots in Waimanalo, and they'll all go to Waianae, and they'll live in Waianae for about 6 months, and then the police will come in and empty out all the parking lots, and they'll go back to Waimanalo. So there's just, like, this migration.
The migration?
Yeah.
Between the ice heads.
Yeah.
It's time to pack up. We got to move on.
Yeah.
At 8 o'clock tonight.
Between the west side and the east side.
After Dog the Bounty Hunter.
Yeah. And so... What did
no,
I
he's
do?
After them.
I actually moved to the North Shore. So
oh, nice.
So I'm on the North Shore now, Papelo Road. Do you know where that
yeah,
is?
Yes, yeah, yes, yes.
Don't give away your address.
What's the number on that one?
Yeah, there's a 73.
We'll just call you. It's
808. 555-12, fuck you.
You'll see
him across
the lines.
Yeah. That's a good surf spot.
That's a great surf spot. Except that you have to paddle out pretty far.
Listen, if you can paddle, look at him.
Yeah, I'm a paddling machine.
My friend,
get people
my friend
to do that
the,
for him.
I actually had
you know,
paddle.
His version of success. Is.
Yeah, I have a paddle driver,
assistant paddler.
I have a chauffeur.
It's a guy in a surfboard suit that just his arms stick out from the side. Yeah.
Valet
I'm
for my board.
Yes. reading Billboard magazine. Yeah.
That's how Mr. Burns, sir.
Can't believe this magazine still exists.
Yeah, exactly.
After each time you guys finish an album or you finish a tour or whatever, do you kind of go, I don't think we're going to be able to do this anymore, and then you get a little bit of rest and you go, ah, fuck it, let's do it again.
That happens to me like weekly.
Every day after every show. Now. Yeah. Oh my God, I'm beat up. I need a day off. Then the next day, all right, back on it.
Well, you know, when Rob joined the band, he brought something up to me that I had never really thought about before. He said, playing your music is very physical. And I thought about it and I thought, well, yeah, it is very physical. I mean, we're not like sitting there strumming like three chords. I mean, we're playing music that's
four.
We're playing music that's physically demanding of, you know.
But he was in Suicidal Tendencies.
Exactly.
That's pretty physical.
Exactly. But, you know.
Yeah, so for him to say that.
Yeah, I know.
Exactly. That's pretty awesome. Yeah.
And so, you know, whenever we play after a show, I'm beat up. My arms are sore. My wrists are sore. My shoulder is sore. My neck is sore. I can't even speak.
Are you in Hawaii on the shore? I know where you're at.
Yeah.
If you try playing Metallica songs like a normal guitar position, your forearm will fucking burn, which is why I figured it out. I dropped the strap and I was like, oh, that makes sense.
You're left-handed?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah. It definitely makes sense if you wear your guitar lower.
Yeah.
Because then you have a freer movement on your arms. But, it, you know, playing this music, it beats you up after a while. When we're on tour, a lot of the physical problems start to compound, and so we bring people out whose job it is to just look after the physical aspect of
yes, you know, maintenance, maintenance. You gotta, you know, if you're that kind of engine, you need a certain kind of maintenance, and that's the reality of it. Yeah. You know, going on to into our 60s and 70s, you know, like the Rolling Stones, who knows, you know? If they tried to play a Metallica song, how tough would it be? And, you know, in whatever, 30 years or 20 years from now, us trying to play a whatever next generation is that, I mean, I hear some music that's blows my mind.
Yeah.
Like, there's no way that's physical music, you know? You know, extremely progressive and intense, nonstop. It's like, how do you even remember that song? how do you?
Seems so, like random notes.
There's always another level, you know. When we sit and complain, it's like, all right, at least I'm not doing that.
In a van.
Yeah. Down by the river.
How do you not blow your voice out?
I just did. Down by the river. How do I not?
Vocal exercises, right?
Yeah, there's some of that. And I go through phases. Like, all right, it depends on the tour. If you're going a long time, well, a long time for us is 2 weeks now. And that's my version of success. You can choose when you have to work, and then you can go full throttle for 2 weeks, take some time off. That works for us. Depending on how long, there's maintenance, different maintenance, you know.
Like, did it get easier to like recover your voice after you stopped drinking, or was there like no difference?
Well, I think when I was drinking, I didn't care either way.
Yeah.
So, well, my voice is fucked up. I don't care. And I drink some more. This helps it, you know, and blah. And it was a complete denial of reality. You know, it was a certain style. So my voice did change. I think over the course of your life or my life. I remember the Black Album tour. Black Album tour lasted 3 years with little breaks here and there. But going 3 years, and actually at that point, there were some times where it was a night with Metallica. You know, no support act, no anything. Us for
shit.
3 hours.
Yeah. That was a long
what punishment
yeah.
for the audience.
And it wasn't just songs too. There was like an open guitar solo, there's a drum duel. There's a long sing along. I mean, it was a lot of.
Is it stuff. Lars versus himself in the drum duel?
No, versus him.
They had
a drum off.
Yeah, and then there was a dinner break. On stage, where we serve food, there was time out. There was alone time for a little bit on stage.
Okay, awesome idea for the fans. Terrible idea for you guys.
Yeah, I'm sure you want to do as much as you can for the fans. But at the end of the day, you're human beings with limitations.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for reminding me that. Yeah. I need that reminder.
But the Black Album, just got so big. Very true.
It was this planets aligned. It was the time. It was it was a great connection for us anywhere in the world. The Black Album, I remember our manager coming out on the road saying, okay, I know you've been out for 2.5 years, but the fifth single is giant in Indonesia right now. We have to go, Yeah. And every time he'd come out, I'd be going, "Oh no, I can't, no!" And as the singer, it seemed like an extra burden I was carrying, and no one wanted to hear my plight whatsoever. It's like, come on, dude, we got to keep going.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll be there. Yay, we're successful!
Yay, this is so fun.
Think of all the piles of money and all the rubber bands. Is there ever? Oh, you go.
Oh no! I was just gonna say, also in regards to the Black Album, that it was also so lucky that you had somebody just happening to film the making of the album and then the tour.
It
was that guy right over there, the director of Fight for Your Right to Party.
Yeah. Do you ever spin the camera around on yourself, sir?
Sometimes.
Okay.
I took it away from me.
You had to take it away from me.
What's it rated? No.
You got to spin it around sometimes and just give a little selfie and give people that.
He'll edit.
You got to cut that out. Yeah.
You can't keep
that.
That must have been pretty crazy though, just because did it feel like this album was going to be bigger than the rest, or did it just feel like it's just the follow up to Injustice for All? It's just like we're a working band, we're doing another album, and then it became like a pop sensation.
Pop sensation. I was pretty blown.
You guys,
out.
Ouch, Bieber,
dude.
And like. Yeah. Oh no!
Well, you know what I mean. It was huge for a metal album.
We knew something was up when we got the initial numbers on how many albums we shipped, or no, how many albums we sold in the first week. And we sold something crazy, like 600,000 albums in the first week, and we had never done that. And that kind of made me think, wow, that's quite a way to start off an album.
Yeah.
Quite a bang, and it just grew from there. And we just kept on adding shows and more shows and more shows and more shows, and after a while we kind of got the idea that this isn't going anywhere anytime soon. But we buckled down and we did what we felt we needed to do, and
the awareness was already happening.
Yeah.
So even if that album was complete crap, it probably would have sold a bunch just as the rise was happening.
Yeah, I was gonna say,
but the fact that the momentum,
it would have tapered off.
Yeah,
was it because of one, because you had a video and it was out there, and that everyone, people that might have not come across a band like yours saw that, and then it was just the next thing to come out. So.
Yeah, after Injustice for All, the video thing started.
I had the VHS of Two of One.
Two of One,
cool.
What
the VHS.
It was $15 for two room videos.
Lars in a hotel room explaining the videos, and I was just like, oh, this is amazing.
Yeah. You bought a video?
Yeah.
That's been my kids. That's weird.
Yeah.
How did, you guys really sort of, you guys at MTV really helped propel a lot of the stuff that was happening at that time. Music video, but now it sort of feels like the music video, it's not dead per se. I mean, obviously people put videos on YouTube, but has your approach to videos now, do you think of it differently? I mean, before I'm sure it was you got to make a video, we got to get into heavy rotation.
Yeah, they're not as integral now to a person's career as they were. I mean, 15 years ago, you had to make a video, and it was like a do-or-die thing. If you had any hope for getting any sort of exposure, you had to do a video. And this is before, you know, YouTube and all those different outlets were even around. But nowadays, you have so many outlets through the internet. I mean, you can make your own video on your iPhone and put it up on YouTube, and, you know, who knows? You might get a million hits. I mean,
U-tunes?
iTunes, awesome.
And U-tunes.
Yeah,
we all speak for it.
You know,
and Looney Tunes. Hey, I prefer.
It's all the same on the interweb.
It is exactly. You know, it was just cutting edge at the time, and there you go. It was a promotional tool, and now.
Now you're doing there,
you, if you don't have Facebook, you know you're stupid. Something like that.
But it's just, that's like you say that the stars aligned. It's just like you were in the right place. You had the right album. You guys were in the right stage of your career.
Timing.
You had the right delivery mechanism.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Grunge was on its way up. Hair metal was on its way out, which really like cleared the playing field for us.
Yeah.
Because we were neither, and so we were kind of like, you know. Alone standing in our own genre, practically. And so, yeah, I mean...
What did you think of hair metal when that was starting to happen at the time? You're like, there's this weird other glammy movement that's happening.
It was a constant source of entertainment for us.
Is that kind of why you left LA? Is because hair metal was taken over?
It was a fuel for us. Yeah. It was a hatred fuel. But it was an energy, nonetheless.
But I'm sure also motivating in the sense that you... I would guess that you probably strove harder to show people, like, we're not that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. We didn't go out of our way, but we made it clear that we were not that. We were not that in look and sound and attitude.
Would you just watch what they were wearing and go, we're just going up in T-shirts and fucking jeans?
Like I said, it was a constant source of entertainment, you know? And there was a time when hair metal was so androgynous, it was only a matter of time before people, the guys were wearing dresses. But then the grunge movement came, and all those guys were wearing dresses. So I thought, oh, there you go.
Right. Well, it's not like there weren't pictures of us in spandex, all right?
Yeah.
We had our moments, all right?
Yeah.
But that was pre-stretch, black stretch pants.
Exactly.
All right.
You just want to set the record straight now.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I like the confession.
Lars, I remember we had this argument about, Lars, why are you still wearing spandex? And he's like, they're not spandex. They're... latex, or I don't know what they were. It's like
black stretchy material, that's like spandex.
Yeah. So that was the tag inside. You know, what is this made of? It's like these are not spandex. Not spandex.
Like it's just black stretchy material, like spandex, but not
spandex.
It's better.
Come on, man.
Betterer, different, better.
It's not spandex, man. He's just clutching a pile of them. Yeah, spandex.
But you know, hair metal served its purpose, and it gave us a lot of, you know, it wasn't music we liked. I grew up in L.A., and it wasn't what I liked.
Yeah.
But that's all there was. So it helped us want to create what we liked. And then we continued with that thought. And, you know, MTV was also the enemy for quite a while. It's like, you turn on MTV, and you're like, oh, my God, please, please, I want to see Iron Maiden,
Jesus Priest.
You know, it's like... You come over to, I remember going over to Dave Mustaine's house, it's like walking in, it's like, dude, you just missed it. He's like, what? You know? Shit, we got to wait another 3 days. You know, now we got to sit through Asia.
And then eventually we had Headbangers Ball.
We had Headbangers Ball, Ricky.
Well, that was way before that even.
But
you know?
But before we got Headbangers Ball, it got really thick with all sorts of hair metal bands, and it drove me crazy. And you're right, you'd have to like watch 3 hours of hair metal bands just to get like Judas or Iron Maiden Run to the Hills.
That's a phenomenon that I completely forgot about, waiting for that video to come on.
Yeah.
You'd have to sit there and watch.
It'd be nonstop.
Just have, like, background. And like you said, if you missed
and you would just get pummeled with like advertising and other bands. And I think that was part of their strategy, I have a feeling.
Not anymore, because people can get whatever they want whenever they want it.
It's a culture of convenience.
Now they're 16 and...
growing up in L.A., what kind of, like, what scene did you get into when you started getting into music? Was, like you know, were you going to, like, you know, metal shows right off the bat or, like, punk shows and stuff like that?
Oh, I don't know. The scene for me was kind of anything my brother had in his collection, you know. I had an older brother who a half brother, 10 years older than me. So he was in a band. He played drums. And, you know, there was his record collection. But out of all the stuff, all of the Beatles, Jethro Tull's, and a lot of the hippie stuff, Jimi Hendrix and Jefferson Airplane, there was the Black Sabbath that I put it on, and that was it.
Yeah,
I loved that. And so from there, it kind of set a tone for me. And I was searching for anything that had something darker or heavier. And, you know, continued searching for that. There was a time where it was all about punk rock, you know, Sex Pistols, Ramones, and all of that. But I was the kid in high school that was walking around with a Scorpions t-shirt with the punk rock glasses on, you know, and everyone's going, take those glasses off, or why are you wearing that shirt, you know? I'm like, I'm in, like, the void. Yeah. I'm between clicks, man. Yeah. You know?
Well, I remember when, I think it was one of the Garage Days reissues, like, it was how I got into the Misfits. It's like, you covered a Misfits song, and I was like, oh, it's a, and then going back, and that's always my favorite thing about music is, like, reading an interview or seeing, like, a band that, like, they're wearing a shirt, or they're, like, they mention a band, and you go and check out that band, because if this band I like likes them, that band. Mm-hmm. And so that was always really cool that, like you know, you guys did that, because it kind of just, it's like, you know, we like these guys and people should check them out, but here's a way of doing it, just doing a cover.
Yeah, I was paying homage to where we were at the time as well, yeah. You know, and here's our influences. If you like us, you might like them.
What was it for you, Kirk? Like, what was it when you were a kid that...
Well, you know, I had a kind of a similar situation to James. I had an older brother who had a record collection, and I was just like... I was just so enamored with his record collection, and it was the first music I started listening to. And I got into stuff like Hendrix and eventually Purple and Black Sabbath. And then when I started playing guitar, I discovered the more European stuff, starting with like Thin Lizzy, and then I discovered UFO. And in my high school... Everyone either listened to Journey or in Van Halen or to, like, you know, Brothers Johnson or whatever. There was no in between except for me and, like, maybe two other people who were listening to UFO and Scorpions and Thin Lizzy. And then I would meet people just in the Bay Area who you know, usually at record stores, who were into the same thing. And I started hanging out with these people, and then this group of people started to grow and grow, and I told them I had this band called Exodus, and we're looking for a singer, and I found Exodus's singer, Paul Bailoff, at a party, and I hired him on the spot because he knew the lyrics to a UFO song. I mean, you know, he didn't even ask him to sing for me. I just said, "You're our vocalist. You're in the band." And
you don't need a word wedge.
Yeah, exactly.
You're gonna save us loads of money.
Yeah,
it's like $100,000 for that
word wedge. And you know, the group of people grew into a scene, and you know, we started meeting more bands, and then we started coalescing around this tiny club called the Old Waldorf, and then that's how, you know, the San Francisco thrash metal scene pretty much started.
Oh, wow.
And it was just a bunch of people in the Bay Area, not very many who were clued into this type of music that was coming out of Britain and Europe. And we found each other, and we created a little scene, and it grew, and nowadays it's what it is. But that's basically, you know, how I got into the scene that I got into in San Francisco. I mean, we all coalesced around this love for a new wave of British heavy metal and you know, harder rock stuff, like, you know, Thin Lizzy and you know, Aerosmith. And it was different from the group of people who were into stuff like Van Halen and, you know, Journey.
Do you remember which record store it was, and is it still there?
Well, it started at the Record Exchange in Walnut Creek, which is where I used to go to, yeah. Which I later found out Lars used to go to a lot around that same time. Yeah. And also the Record Vault in San Francisco.
Vault.
Yeah. And that was the galvanizing place. That's where everyone who went to the nightclubs at night went to the record vault during the day. And, you know, we'd go to the record vault during the day and see all the same faces that you would see at, you know, this one metal club at night. And it just grew from there.
Yeah. It's kind of a bummer that there's no, I mean, like, the idea of real world locations, just sort of the sort of preciousness of, like, oh, there's a, this is a community, but it's a real community because they have to go make an effort to meet somewhere, yeah, and exactly, gather on a thing rather than just like, eh, I'll just sign on and, yeah, you know, I mean, it's kind of, I feel like that it's unfortunate that we have lost that. Like,
we've
like,
lost so much, man, in the name of
convenience.
And it's, you know, technology. I'm hoping that it'll come back.
I think, I mean, in my reality, there's a, you're going global and everything, but local has its charm. Local, whatever, you know, farmers markets, food, you know, buy locally, all of that stuff is coming back for food. I think it might come back for, you know, people meeting, groups and stuff like that, like you're talking about, you know?
Yeah, I feel like it's still there.
I feel like it expands out, and then it's got to collapse on itself, and then it just comes back in a little bit.
I think that stuff is always there. The important thing is that it needs to be taught to newer generations, because it's not a natural thing for them. And, you know, they need to be shown that, you know, there's life beyond a keyboard and a monitor when it comes to meeting people and, like, actually, like, fostering, you know, a community. I mean, there's...
I see kids now, they take guitar lessons online with, like, over Skype. I can't imagine.
Oh, really?
I can't imagine.
There's some bands that'll go online when they forget their lyrics or whatever and watch people sing.
That's insane.
Who would do that?
I
forgot the guitar part. Frank in Kansas City. Who knows? Right.
Shit, Frank's good.
Oh, wow. That's actually better.
Thanks, Frank.
If you burn your arm Frank's again, you just call Frank up.
Yeah. Well, 'cause there are some people who've essentially just devoted their lives to just learning your stuff, and so they get so granular with it in a way that, you know, you can't anymore because you're off doing other things. Like, I remember I saw maybe it was like 6 or 7 years ago, I saw David Lee Roth perform with a Van Halen cover band at Bumbershoot, and it was fucking awesome because the band had basically, they just nailed all the Van Halen stuff, and then you had Dave and he had, like, the I guess it was a wig, I don't know, but he was Diamond Dave, like, yellow fucking spandex.
No shit.
The hair, doing kicks and shit, and then they were playing Van Halen, and it was like, it's a fucking Van Halen, like, it's...
So David Lee Roth dressed up as David Lee Roth from the 80s,
and
got up with the cover band, was tits on,
because
that's all they focus on.
That's right.
That's like seeing them again.
It really was.
How awesome.
It really was.
What's the difference between that and Guns N' Roses now?
Yeah, that's very true.
You know?
This is true. A bucket head.
Really.
A bucket head.
Yeah.
How have you guys managed it? I mean, it's hard to keep any sort of group together for around any purpose. I mean, people are going to grow. They're going to evolve in different areas. So how have you guys managed to do it? How have you guys managed to sort of...
How have you dealt with Lars?
You know, look, I didn't want to.
You know,
let's just.
You're spot on.
You know my thing.
But if he was here, how do you deal with James, right? Exactly.
I have a very positive outlook toward people in general, and I have a very positive outlook with people I have relationships with, and that pretty much guides my whole life. And, you know, playing with these guys is such a great thing for me, and it's such a great thing, I hope, for them. And I know it's such a great thing for people out there, I hope, that, you know, I don't want to stop that. I don't want to end that, because I'm so happy being in where I am right now in this band. And I hope everyone else in the band feels the way that I do. And
sorry, bro.
Yeah, I was just playing my violin.
That's what I love about Some Kind of Monster. And you know, tensions are tight, and then you're just like, I'm just gonna go surf. I just need to just go surf.
Everyone has their different processes.
Yeah, I remember seeing that and going, like, what a shaman.
It's like any relationship, as simple as that. You know, being married is not easy. It's hard, and you can easily start bickering, point out all the negative aspects of someone and how it bugs you and blah, blah, blah. And just, you know, bands do that. And they, you know, but there's an imbalance, you know. There's whatever egomaniac with an insecurity complex, you know, exactly that. If you don't focus on the good stuff and care for that, all the negativity comes in. I mean, Kirk is really good, like you said, about the positiveness of it all. I can find the negative in pretty much anything and try to fix it or make it better or something, you know, the perfectionist in me. And Lars is the brain. I mean, he can analyze and he can figure anything out. And Robert is the loose, cool guy, but he's the warrior. He's the, let's fucking do it, you know, step up, you know. Each one of us has an important role in this band, and we can't forget that. All of us need to realize that, and together, we're one mega person. Yes. We're one.
Mega Metallica.
We're like Godzilla.
Godzilla.
At the end of the day, it is all about just the balance that you have in the band and in the cards you're dealt with. You know, some people are in bands with people whose personalities are just like hard to deal with or explosive or whatever. And you know, some people can compensate for that in their own band. Some people can't. So I mean, I personally, I think it all comes down to the cards you're dealt, and you know, if you can keep your band together with the personalities and the chemistry that you're given, you know, great. If you can't, you know, totally understandable.
Well, I wonder if that sort of that idea of perfectionism is almost detrimental in some ways, because you're always looking for the crack in something, which means you might be creating it so that you can fix it, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, it's a never-ending gig. Fixing the world is insane. You know, it's insane thinking, you know?
You thought the Black Album tour was long.
Exactly. Yeah. You know,
that was insane thinking right there.
Yeah, there's that saying, you know, why carpet the world, wear slippers, you know? I have to remember that every day. But yeah, you know, a curse and a gift at the same time. It's driven me to get where I've been or am, but it's also, it can be destructive, you know, in my personal family, in the band, and things like that. It's, you know, too much negativity is not good. So being balanced. These guys help me stay balanced.
Yeah. So the do you want to talk a little bit about Through the Never?
What is that?
The song.
Oh, the movie thing?
Yeah.
Is that why we're here?
The movie thing.
3D, guys.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the movie thing.
We wanted it in VD.
What?
It would have been like the Ride the Lightning tour.
Exactly. Black Album all over again. Yeah, you guys really wanted a best of. Here you go.
I remember.
What happened on the tour?
I remember I used to have to occasionally drive certain band members to the clinic.
Back in the day. Because I was one of the only ones that had a car back in the day.
You don't have to.
Actually, I didn't have a car. I used to borrow my mom's car.
That's adorable stuff.
I would have to say to my mom, "Mom, I have to borrow the car." She said, "Why?" And I couldn't say, I had to drive blank to the clinic. I would just say, "Oh, we're gonna go to the movies." She's like, "Okay."
You see a lot of movies, yeah. I'm a film fan.
It was a crazy weekend.
Yeah. Hey, blank, you ready?
Let's go. So yeah, there's some accuracy there when you said VD and Ride the Light.
Yes. All right.
And thanks, Kirk's mom, by the way.
Finally. Give her the shout out.
Finally, shout out.
Whose idea was it? Let's do a movie, let's do a fucking 3D and IMAX.
You know, well, the idea to do an IMAX movie has been around for a while, for at least 10 years. I mean, I can remember we tried to get an IMAX movie off the ground around then, but for some reason or another, it just didn't happen. So that idea was kind of percolating in the back of our heads until our manager brought the idea up again about 3 years ago. But then it was not just an IMAX movie, but it was IMAX in 3D with this gigantic stage that he had a vision for. And, you know, we were kind of into it. We were kind of tentative. And so one day we had a band meeting. I think it was in Ireland. And they had already had all these renderings of the stage in 3D on computer. And they're, you know, basically showing that to try, you know, to sell us on the idea. And once we saw the renderings and all the, like, the rough ideas for what they had for the stage, I think we're sold by that point. But
you were like, oh, you already put so much work into it, I guess.
Yeah, we spent all this money.
I'll mortgage my house here.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. My family's happy with peanut butter and jelly. It's fine.
Yeah. But as far as, like, you know, the narrative, I don't know where that idea came from.
I totally know. My reality of it is similar to Kirk's, as in it's been a long-standing idea to do a movie in a theater, which would be great, you know, besides some kind of monster. The accidental
That's
movie.
Not a movie. That's a documentary.
Yes.
Okay.
Docudrama.
Yeah.
But the idea of the best of show, you know, the crosses from Master of Puppets, the Doris crumbling, the Lady Justice from Justice, and all the stuff that people missed, and for the new fans. So doing a best of was an idea, and here that ties in with our movie idea and 3D movie. So when they started pitching us with the stage and everything you're talking about, and telling, you know, how much that cost, and but we can use it on tour for the next 5 years, you know, we'll make our money back on it, blah blah blah. That was around the time when, you know, the Rolling Stones 3D movie, the U2 movie was out there, and going to see those, going, oh my god, we can't do this. I mean, how many times can you swing the mic in front of
you? Yeah. Oh, he's going to hit me in the face. Yeah.
Maybe I'll sing. You know, corny, man. I mean, okay, there's a short life to that. It's cool, but there's a short life. We got it. I mean, if we're going to do a movie, let's do something really cool and different. You know, let's... You know, I started thinking of, like, the Beatles and Help, or even the Monkees, you know. Yeah. Like, they're goofing off. There's a story. There's something else happening. And, oh, yeah, song remains the same. Yeah, it's a little too trippy. The Wall. All of these other movies that had legs, that made a statement. So we got to have a narrative. We got to have something. There's a story. And then the ideas just started flowing, like... Wait, there's got to be cartoon. You know, we got to turn into cartoons. We got to blah blah blah. We got to animate it. Yeah. We got to
Cthulhu comes out the audience.
Exactly. You know, CGI this and that.
Then all of a sudden, you get to become like teenagers in a band. Like, then we'll do.
Oh, totally. Yes. It was great.
Yeah, and then we woke up.
Yeah. No one was saying no. You can't say no. Yeah. And then you get the bill, and you go, "Holy shit!
$1 billion! Yeah, we spent $1 billion."
That's a lot of rubber bands, dude. You know, it's like building your dream house. You know, the architect's going, sure, we can do that. Yeah, let's do that. No and, problem. Oh, bowling alley? Of course. Yeah. And then reality brings you back down. Okay, so, but you have to go big so you can concentrate again, you know. So all the best ideas that happen start to boil down into a concentrated, you know, real dense, good idea. So... From there, we went and then started, you know, getting treatments, getting the producer, getting the director, and things like that. So the idea had been around for a while, but had morphed into something completely different. And
It was really interesting because when we put the word out there that we're looking for directors and wanted to see some treatments, we got like four treatments that the management thought that we should look at. Three of them were sci-fi themed, and then there was Nimrod's, and the sci-fi thing. I mean, it was obvious with every single one that these were ideas that had been in these guys' back pockets, just waiting to throw it on the table, you know, to get made. Nimrod's seemed like his ideas started from the ground up. I mean, it seemed like he actually thought about Metallica and thought about how. What sort of cinematic storyline would fit in with our music? It seemed like that, and 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 his treatment was very malleable. I mean, it had a lot of room for, like, changing it and steering it in the direction that we felt we needed to steer it in. And so, I mean, that's pretty much how we ended up working with Nimrod, is that his treatment just felt good, and it felt like it was the best match for Metallica, yeah. Other than some weird outer space thing, you know, with, like, you know, post-apocalyptic planet and us playing in the middle of some, like...
Then you're making some, like, you're making, like, Head, like, the monkeys, like, sort of, like, really weird, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah,
Lips movie.
Yeah, or, like, who knows, it could have been Waterworld, the heavy metal version of Waterworld.
That doesn't sound so bad at all.
Well, not bad. Your stage would still be running at Universal Studios. Yeah.
Or Waterboy.
Yeah,
even better.
Yeah. Adam Sandler.
That would pave the way for the Metallica stunt spectacular. Plus, Orlando.
I mean, the name Nimrod, you got to sign him up.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Exactly.
That was the first thing my kids asked him. Is that your real name?
That poor guy's the bane of his existence.
Yes. Everyone asks me.
Yeah.
Do you actually call him Nimrod? And I say, no, I call him Nim.
You can change it.
He can change
it. I call him Rod.
Yeah.
Well, we're about at the end of our...
No.
I know you wanted to keep going.
No.
I know. This was really fun though, and it seems like you guys are, you're comedy guys, like you like comedy.
We like to laugh, yeah.
I mean, but you actually do
we
stuff
hate
with
metal.
Yeah, you do stuff with Brendan Small.
That's why we're in Comic Con, right?
No, it's not that kind of comics. It's not that kind of comics.
Hey, Brian Posehn's coming later on.
Right. Brian Posehn, what are you guys doing? Star Wars. Look at the girls.
He loves Hawaii, by the way. He's always coming out.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Every time he's in Hawaii, that's when I get a text from him.
Yeah.
He's just like, I can't believe you grew up here.
He's
like, I'm being miserable.
Yeah, what do you call him? Beach monkey, no, sand monkeys.
Yeah.
He calls the locals sand monkeys.
Nice.
They love that.
Yeah.
Oh, Posehn.
Well, yeah. Because, you know, they call people Hallies, and Brian's like, yeah. All right, I'm going to call you sand monkeys.
I love howling.
Yeah. Shaloma.
Shaloma.
Instead of aloha, shaloma.
Well, this was it was so tempting. I think Joan was a little bit nervous because he has a bit about Lars and his stand-up.
I had a weird Lars interaction once a long time ago at a party.
And he just had a comedy special.
We all have. It's okay.
Yeah, you can talk.
It's a safe place to talk about
yesterday.
It.
It's okay.
Well, when like Metallica came up on the counter, I was like, holy shit, this is, oh no. I was like, I don't think I can go. And it was like, oh, it's going to be Kirk and James. He was like, fuck yeah.
I'm sure he didn't see my half hour special. I'm sure he doesn't, you know, traverse the, you know,
oh,
Comedy
yes,
Central.
Oh, yes, he does.
He loves Comedy Central.
Yeah.
He probably knows all about it.
Yeah.
But it was
we've all taken shots, all right?
Yeah.
At this point, but there's some bulletproof to us, but you know, it's out of him being a character, all right?
Yeah, he's an easy target.
He is an easy target, but he's an amazing guy.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we all
I mean,
know that.
It was a lot of fun hanging out. He was, you know, he was telling me a lot of stories about seeing Sam Kinison in San Francisco when he was younger. And
Sand! It's sand! Throw a candy bar at him!
Yeah, the film crew couldn't give this kid a sandwich.
The mommy's pussy! I mean, the mommy's pussy!
Fuck that. That's so hilarious.
Oh, man.
You better end this.
Yeah. But that Sam in the day.
Oh, yeah.
We would all go together.
Oh, he was our hero.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and then he became, like, he's recorded songs.
Yeah,
yeah,
he became a rock star.
Wild Thing or something, then, yeah.
Oh, with what's her name? Oh.
Yeah. Was it Tony Kazane? Was it Tony? It was like
no,
some...
the Jim Baker chick, remember?
Oh, there was a couple of women in his life that were pretty destructive.
Yeah, Serena, the porn star.
It's like Angie Everhart or something like
no,
that?
No, it was she used to call him the Stern all the time, and I can't remember her name.
Yeah, it was the one that went extremely psycho on him.
It's a question for the internet.
Yeah.
Oh,
ask Mr. Google.
Yes. All right. Well, thanks, guys.
Second,
right.
That was her name.
Second.
Good to see you. Yeah.
Enjoy
so,
your burrito.
You lived in Kailua?
Yeah, I was born in Kailua.
The end.
And now
you.
We turn it over to Hawaii talk.
I moved out of
with
like,
Kirk
my
and Jonah.
Place. I lived in Kamakee for a little bit.
Really,
in this,
not a great
sand.
Place.
Sand. Sand.
Hawaii is full of sand.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was like so close to UH that I used to just go and ride my bike.
Jesus Christ.
What?
Yeah, all right.
I,
local reference guy.
He used to live in Waimanalo.
Me and my brother used to go to, we went to show St. Louis. You guys can fucking stop.
What the fuck? That's so fucking funny. We're talking about Hawaii.
The epilogue, the podcast epilogue.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.